Curtis Hill has a Republican challenger. Buttigieg at the first Democratic presidential primary debates. That, plus a class action suit against DCS, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending June 28th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill will have a Republican challenger next year if he runs for re-election, as Zionsville Attorney John Westerkamp announced his bid. Curtis Hill is seen as vulnerable because of allegations he groped four women last year. Republican leaders have called on him to resign, though Hill remains defiant that he's done nothing wrong. John Westerkamp mostly sidestepped questions about Hill, except for this.
I think the distractions around the Attorney General's office is not good for the state of Indiana, and we need new leadership.
Westerkamp's platform is largely the same as Curtis Hill's. He focused on opposition to abortion and robocalls. But the 30-year-old Republican did try to differentiate himself.
Indiana needs an attorney general that will take seriously the fiduciary duty to collaborate with state legislators and the administration. I intend to represent the state with integrity, judgment, and loyalty.
Republican convention delegates will decide next year who gets the GOP nomination. Can Westerkamp mount a serious challenge to Curtis Hill? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Leslie Weidenbender, managing editor of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, can a 30-year-old attorney who's never run for public office before beat Curtis Hill at the convention?
No.
So is the
I think the Republicans are going to renominate Curtis Hill. I do. I think it's a disgrace that they're going to renominate him, but I think they're going to renominate him.
Is this the only candidate other than only other Republican candidate we'll see? Or do you think there's more out there?
There could be more out there. Todd Rokita's always kind of allowed his name to be in that mix, and he's a guy who can get in late, right? Yeah. And has a deep history in that, you know, in that convention
deep
hall.
Deep history. With,
well, he's got a long
definitely
he's,
has a long history in that.
They nominate
convention.
Him twice for statewide elected officially. Yeah.
And won a contentious convention battle.
Right. Yeah.
So he knows
absolutely.
He literally.
So
knows
he knows.
How to
so
do
he,
it.
He knows exactly how to do that. You know, it's you know, you're appealing to 1,500 people, right? This isn't being 30 and having not run before. You're not running for president of the United States. You know, you're where you got to go raise or governor where you got to go raise $20 or $30 million. You're operating in a convention hall and you're working your way around the state over the next 12 months, sitting in people's living rooms who are running for delegate or helping recruit delegates and people to run. So it just takes doing the work. And John's been out doing the work.
He didn't just all of a sudden this week decide, oh, I'm running for attorney general.
Right.
He said he's been exploring it for 6 months.
Right.
I think there could very well be other candidates, though. And it's so early. We've got people who we don't even know who's running for governor, and this is, these are and these
spoiler
are,
alert.
Very very good. These are races decided at a convention. They're not. There's no primary battle. There is all the time in the world for additional candidates to step up, and I think we're probably going to see some.
The more candidates you have, the more likely it's going to be Curtis Hill.
Yeah, is Curtis Hill the biggest fan of more
but
candidates?
But you're assuming that all of those candidates go into the convention.
But you would also have, like, with Republicans, and I'm on state committee, so part of this is on us to lead this message and support the governor and Republican leaders who have called for Curtis Hill to resign, which is not going to happen, right? But it's a recognition that we might not be able to win the general election in November, and we have to go nominate another candidate. And the more candidates you have out there saying that and saying, I'm in this, not because I care about what happened in the past, but because we have to protect this seat in November.
So is the governor going to get in that then? Is the governor going to wade in among the convention
delegates? The governor's been pretty clear.
For somebody else?
Well, that remains to be seen. I don't know what the field looks like or where we're going to be at next June. But he has been consistent, and he's not backing off of declaring that Curtis Hill should resign, that he's not fit for office, and that he's not our best candidate for Attorney General next November.
Nikki, you and I were at the Westerkamp's announcement, and we both thought the same thing, which was he doesn't sound really all that different from Curtis Hill.
No, I mean, philosophy-wise, they agree on pretty much everything. I mean, I think what the voters need to decide isn't, you know, it's not going to be an issue-based race. It's going to be,
well, there will be
will
one
the
issue.
Baggage that Curtis Hill brings affect them in the fall? And you know, is it worth renominating him to, quote, stick by him for groping women at a bar? Or do we want to look at the sort of big picture, not the small picture?
Because I just can't imagine that they would renominate him. They've already called for him to resign. Like, I mean,
well, the leadership has called for him to resign.
And they didn't,
the leadership
still,
is not
I
equal
just,
to delegates.
They didn't even sanction him. They
I understand,
even vote
but
to sanction
I
him.
Think there's a big difference. I would really be stunned if they renominated him.
Bet.
All right,
ooh. You're on.
Well, we didn't say what the stakes were, but that's our. We'll
that's
off.
On
well,
TV.
Money would be illegal.
Right, that becomes that becomes legal in September. So, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will Curtis Hill be the Republican nominee for Attorney General in 2020? A yes or B no. Last week's question, does Representative Susan Brooks not running for re-election make it easier for Democrats to win that seat in 2020? 65% of you say yes, 35% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, 20 Democratic presidential candidates faced off in two televised debates this week, including South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. The debates were at times chaotic, with 10 candidates each night talking over each other, but some of the Democrats managed to stand out. Julian Castro and Elizabeth Warren the first night, Senator Kamala Harris the night after, particularly in a heated exchange with Joe Biden. Perhaps the most notable part of Pete Buttigieg's performance dealt with the recent police shooting of a black man in his hometown.
It's a mess, and we're hurting. And I could walk you through all of the things that we have done as a community. All of the steps that we took from bias training to de-escalation, but it didn't save the life of Eric Logan. And when I look into his mother's eyes, I have to face the fact that nothing that I say will bring him back.
The South Bend mayor scored points when talking about faith, a theme he's used throughout his campaign to attack the Republican Party.
For a party that associates itself with Christianity, to say that it is okay to suggest that God would smile on the division of families at the hands of federal agents, that God would condone putting children in cages, has lost all claim to ever use religious language again.
Mike O'Brien, on such a crowded stage over two nights, did Buttigieg manage to stand out?
He had the worst week of his campaign, and this kind of capped off the worst week of his campaign, but I do think he handled the South Bend, when he was attacked on stage, on the South Bend issue, on the police shooting. I thought he handled that well. He hit it head on. He didn't try to, you know, dance around it or say, here's why it's not my fault. So that's a winning approach, you know, for any politicians watching. That's the winning approach. Just be honest and own it immediately, and then nobody can hit you on it again, right?
Right.
So I thought he handled that well.
A little bit.
I mean, we're kind of involved in politics a little bit. And I didn't know. I'm watching the debate the last two nights, and there are a lot of people I've never heard of. I mean, there were a couple on stage last night.
You haven't been a Marianne Williams fan.
And the problem with that and what's happening, and you see it happen in real time when they go, hey, raise your hand if you support middle-class tax cuts, and Bernie's, like, putting his hand up. Or middle tax increases, right?
Increases.
And Bernie's putting his hand up, and then everyone's got to kind of figure out what they're, you know, whether they're raising their hand or not. You've got people on there that are not going to be the nominee, like, never. They probably won't even be in, some of those people won't even be in a Democrat administration if that happens. But the effect you have is they are dragging, I think the Democrat assumption, which I think is false and risky for them, is that they believe, and you're seeing it in these 20 candidates or 30 really, some just haven't made the cut, to get on the stage. They assume that if they're standing there on election day in 2020, if you're a Democrat, you're the president, period. So bring your liberal wish bag of every crazy idea you've had for the last quarter century, and run it, whether it's universal health care for all, whether it's decriminalizing illegal immigration, whatever it is, bring it to that stage. And so the legitimate candidates are getting drugged to the left. And so, like, a Joe Biden, who is supposed to be, like, he has the image of, like, hey, here's the normal guy who you normally thought of as a president before Donald Trump. Well, now he's got to go buy into all that. And so these debates the last time, two were very instructive for that reason. You've got people that have no business being on that stage really affecting the policies they're running on.
The rap the last go-round was that the heavy hand was put on Hillary Clinton's campaign, and Bernie Sanders got a raw deal on that. Nobody can complain about that now. Everybody's out there.
No, you've gone to the other side.
That's right. But those numbers will be whittled down. I mean, there'll be higher thresholds to meet. It'll be done systematically and fairly. And we will be left with viable candidates for those offices. And I thought that Pete Buttigieg, you know, I frankly think that being mayor is of any city is one of the toughest jobs there is, okay? You are close enough to the public, and you have these kinds of incidents, which we've had in every city across the country. I thought he handled it as well as he could have handled it. And I thought
the decisions you make on a day-to-day basis have an immediacy to their effect.
And people have no hesitancy to call you up and tell you that, you know, as opposed to
insulated. Exactly.
Whatever happens within that city is your deal.
But he is handling it. He is doing well with it. And the Pete Buttigieg you saw on that stage, the calm, the cool, the collected, the intelligent Pete Buttigieg, that's the real person. And despite the week he's had, he was able to come forward, put and articulate his views, and by all the pundits' assessments of it, was one of the winners of that debate.
Yeah, it seemed like he was being mentioned usually as a...
Obviously, Kamala Harris came out as the top winner last night, but Pete Buttigieg was definitely top tier, 2-3, as far as performance. And, you know, that's what he needed to do. He needed to be steady. He needed to handle that South Bend question that he knew was coming, and he did. And he's obviously going on to the next round of debates. So, I mean, for them, it's one of those sort of check the box, got through that, gained a little, you know, not a lot, but gained, didn't go down, and see where
He'd already had his breakout moment.
Yeah.
So this debate was not going to be a breakout moment for him. What he needed to do was to show that he deserved to be considered in that upper tier of candidates. One of the things I thought was interesting is how much coverage or how many mentions I saw of a possible Harris Buttigieg ticket, and I think that's very interesting. Obviously, Pete Buttigieg is running to try to be the president, but I thought that was a very intriguing possibility. Is a ticket like that.
And what shows you, too, what's amazing about this, you can say what you want about people not belonging up there, but when you can have an African-American woman and another serious woman candidate and a gay man and all representing the party, that's in sharp contrast with who we see as Republican potentials.
I didn't mean diversity.
Lawyers on behalf of 9 Indiana children filed a class action lawsuit in federal court this week against the Department of Child Services. Among the suit's allegations, the agency isn't equipped to handle the specific needs of children with disabilities, and it's placing too many kids in psychiatric hospitals. According to the complaint, some of the children named as plaintiffs have been shuffled between foster homes more than 15 times. Advocates say the children aren't seeking monetary damages, but policy changes. Leslie Weidenbender, how much impact will this suit have in this ongoing debate about DCS?
I think it will be impactful. I think it will make a big difference. Lawsuits do that. That's why they get filed. And and this is one of those situations where the state has been trying over the years to figure out what to do. They obviously haven't hit the right either the right amount of money or the right combination of management or the right combination of services, but there have been a lot of attempts. This pushes them to keep trying to get it right.
What struck me about the lawsuit is, one, they aren't looking for just money, because a lot of times people, I think, hear that and go, oh, well, they're just after money. This is, they are attacking direct policies and saying you should change them. Does that make this more impactful?
It could. I mean, I do think we need to be prepared, though. I mean, litigation like this takes a long time. So this is not going to be any short-term fix that we're going to see changes about. And obviously, also, the state is a little pinned in a bit, because if they make a change, then they can use that kind of as a backdoor of, see, we were right that you were doing X wrong. They actually changed it.
Although that might be a little better, since they aren't seeking money.
Damages.
True.
Right.
So anything the state does in the meantime could actually end up heading off something at the end. But you're right. I mean, when a lawsuit's filed, there are things that sort of stop, too.
Scrutiny around DCS had started to die down a little bit after the tumult of last year and all of the policy changes that went into place, all of the money that, that went into the agency, does this make sure that it doesn't die down entirely?
I think so, because I think the governor declared the problem fixed. He said, we put the money in it, and we're going to do this and that and the other thing, the problem's gone. And clearly the problem is not gone.
Yeah, I don't think he said the problem is gone.
Well, he said they fixed it, all right? And what worries me about this, too, is the number of cases closing and all, and I wonder whether what we're doing is closing them without adequate investigation and without the kind of remedy that is necessary to protect children. They've got to deal with this, okay? They've got to deal with it. I applaud these nine families for coming forward with this because this is going to be very difficult for them to do. And they, as they said, are not seeking to become rich on this. They're just seeking to have the children treated fairly. And I think that's a goal we ought to all share.
This is an agency that you can't turn the ship fast. And the ship is being turned. Whether it's the right direction or not remains to be seen. But does some of this lawsuit going to just be, well, we're trying, just give us time?
It kind of struck me as a little tone deaf. I mean, first, as a national organization, they filed these lawsuits in other states, and so this is something they seem to just go around and do. It seemed like if this conversation would have been a better one a year ago, when we were in the what do we do? Not now we've figured that out between the legislative session and just the administrative power to go and make these changes and the increased money that takes effect like Monday, literally.
Not really increased money, technically increased.
Well, appropriated money. How about that? Because before they were trying to
technically appropriated less money than they're spending, but whatever.
But I think, to Nikki's point, I think if your goal is really to affect policy change, well, we have a legislature that just had this conversation over the last 6 months.
Yeah, but they don't do it.
The lawsuit ensures that they follow through on some of the things that they said
exactly
they were going
right
to do. And we all know, whether it's intentional or not, that government and legislature are not always that good. They work on a problem. Can we let them fail first?
This
is not necessarily
them?
The kind
They've
of issue that
failed.
You want them to fail on
no.
first.
Right,
so,
because children get hurt.
Yeah, yes.
That's true. All right, well, a controversial Indiana virtual school is suddenly, and with little fanfare, shutting down. The Indiana Virtual School and its sister school, the Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy, have been the subject of considerable controversy over the last several months, mostly prompted by bombshell reports from Chalkbeat, Indiana. The Daleville School Board recently unanimously and with no discussion voted to close the schools. Left unanswered are questions about allegations of serious mismanagement of the schools, including accusations the two online institutions enrolled thousands of inactive students. Daleville recommended revoking the school's charters earlier this year. The agreement approved recently will close the virtual school in September, while its students can transfer to the Virtual Pathways Academy, which will then close at the end of the upcoming school year. Nikki Kelly, this conversation around private and virtual school oversight is not over with these closings, is it?
Oh, no. I mean, we're in a time and age where people can get college degrees online. So they do have to find a way to make something like this work. I mean,
and there's been an issue up in your area.
Yeah, there are always going to be kids who just don't work in a traditional school setting. But so, yeah, we already have a school in Fort Wayne that is trying to open an operator of a failing school that's not allowed to take new vouchers, suddenly separated. Now they're going to create a new school so they can take new vouchers again. And they have said they're going to rely largely on virtual curriculum. So they definitely need to find the solution to this so that the kids get served and, you know, money is being used appropriately and not being siphoned away from others.
There was a lot of attention on these two schools over the last few months, in part, as I said, driven a lot by the reporting that Chalkbeat and others had done. With these schools being closed, though, how do you, by the time we get to the 2020 legislative session, how do we ensure that the eyes are still on it?
The truth is, when you have all these new kinds of charter schools, and you know, years ago the legislature decided that schools needed competition, public schools needed competition, and that's how we ended up down this road. And so what happens, though, with competition is some of these schools are going to fail and some of them are going to make it. But there's so much more at risk that the state really has to figure out a way about being more aggressive and not letting schools get so far down the path of not succeeding, which I think is a situation that has happened here. And so I think the issue, like you mentioned with Nikki, is just not going to go away, that there is going to continue to be these kinds of questions over and
well,
over.
Well, they should be.
Obviously, a virtual school shouldn't be treated the exact same way as a traditional public school or even a private school, or a regular private school. But why can't they seem so far to find the right mix here of oversight?
Well, I think they're trying. I think that there were efforts, that there were successful efforts this session to try to tighten up, one, who can establish one of these schools, because arguably these virtual schools never should have been established the way they were. On a statewide basis, by one school district, so tighten that up, which they did. And the State Board of Education looked at this and had a committee that was chaired by a Democrat who came up with recommendations on how to begin tightening this up. They had the conversation this session over, you know, should a virtual school be funded at the same as a charter school, even though the overhead and the expenses aren't equal, so they lowered that percentage as well. So the legislature has taken steps. This is an outlier example, I think. What would be awful is if virtual learning, because of this example, is now somehow tightened up, because it's growing everywhere. It's growing in higher ed for working families. It's growing. I have a special needs daughter who can't get through a whole school day.
Right.
So there is a need for it.
Is there a part of this that needs to be cautioned? Let's not go too far and throwing
We've already put $70 million a year into these virtual schools. And as my understanding is, when the child is logged in on day one, they've paid for the year, whether they ever log in again or not. And the problem with this is not simply what we're reimbursing them and what they're getting. It's the oversight. It's the transparency. It's the sweetheart deals that are going on with the arrangers of these virtual institutions with subsidiaries that they also have a financial interest in. And my husband introduced a provision, which passed, asking for a study commission to look at exactly these questions. But guess what? They didn't vote to have one. And when we're spending $70 million, which is about a $1,200 a teacher pay raise annually, on this kind of thing, we need to know where this money's spent. One of those schools that closed in Daleville was $9.75 million flushed. And we don't seem to care about that, or the legislature doesn't seem to care about that.
I think they do seem to care about it.
I don't think they care about it enough to study it and have transparency in where the money's going.
Well, Vice President Mike Pence this week launched Latinos for Trump, what he called, quote, one of the most important coalitions of the 2020 campaign. Pence says President Trump is a champion of Latino and Hispanic Americans and has been expanding opportunities for Latino business owners since he took office. Hispanic voters are projected to overtake African Americans as the largest racial or ethnic minority group in the 2020 electorate. Trump earned just 28% of the Latino vote in 2016, barely improving on Mitt Romney's 27% from 2012, and underperforming compared to John McCain in 2008, who got 31% of Latino voters to cast a ballot for him. As Latino voters, Mike O'Brien, become more and more influential in national campaigns and local campaigns in a lot of places, are Republicans at risk of losing ground with those voters?
Well, potentially. I mean, we called them rapists and murderers in 2016, and 28% voted for us. So there's some growth opportunity here too. I think what you're going to see
could be rapists, murderers, child molesters.
But in all seriousness, I mean, look, this was the topic in the last two nights of the debate. I mean, anyone who walks into 2020 and says all these candidates are the same is crazy, because you have whatever you believe about Donald Trump's immigration policies, you are going to have the literal opposite on the Democrat side. The last two nights were about decriminalizing illegal immigration. Pete Buttigieg led the charge last night on saying not only should the 11 or 13 million people that are here illegally today be allowed to stay, but we should buy them health care while we're at it.
There is
going to be a vigorous debate on immigration next year, and if you're a Latino voter who is a voter and you are here legally, you may be a little offended by this notion that you've taken all these steps to come here if you immigrated here and did it the right way, and now you've got Democrats who are saying everybody's in unchecked.
They're not saying that, and you know they're not saying that. And by the way, when you talk about illegal health care, illegals being provided with health care, we're already doing that. We've been doing that for years, okay? That's what emergency rooms are for. They don't turn them down. They don't ask for their paperwork. So that's already being done. But the irony of this is it's not simply what Donald Trump called all the Hispanics coming, which he did in the 2016 campaign. Now they have the visual of him ripping children from the arms of their parents and putting them in cages, and children dying in U.S. detention because of lack of care. Those are images, it seems to me. That 27% is at risk.
Was Mike Pence the right messenger for Latinos for Trump?
Well, I mean, you know, he's the second guy on the ticket. Yeah. If you can't go to him, I mean, that's a problem, right? Yeah. You know, it's obviously a big issue. He has demonized some of the immigration population, President Trump, obviously, over the years. So they know it's a big thing, and they're taking a swing.
Is Donald Trump going to be the thing that holds them back in 2020?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's
no doubt
about that.
But is there growth past that?
There absolutely is, because so as immigrant families have children who are no longer immigrant families, as they we get into second and third generations, and people get into the workforce and have higher incomes, all their political opinions will change. Yeah. And maybe they'll remain supporters of Democrats. Maybe they won't.
Right. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Leslie Weidenbender of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.